For a chunk of the human population, it is important for people to enter marriage without having had sex. For a subset of that group, it is critical that women in particular reach their wedding day pure. And that, pure, is the title of Linda K. Klein's book all about the pressure the expectations put on young females. The full title of the book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women, and How I Broke Free. Linda K. Klein earned a master's degree studying American evangelical Christian gender and sexuality messages to girls. She's the founder of Break Free Together, which brings people together to talk about sexuality in small groups over dinner. Linda K. Klein, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that growing up, you were told that there were two types of girls. What are they?
Pure and impure. Those are the two categories that you can fall into. You know, and ultimately, unfortunately, it's not just about not having sex before marriage. The number of things that could have you be fit into the category of impure, which is defined by the community, was quite wide-ranging. Some people thought that if you had an intimate emotional relationship with someone of the opposite sex, that you were threatening your purity. It was quite a range of possibilities. So ultimately, you were shamed for not only your own sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors, which were difficult to pin down, but also the sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors of men in the community toward you, for which you were blamed because of how you dressed or how you walked or how you talked or any number of other things.
So the burden of lust then always falls on the female, never on the male in that culture?
That's generally the teaching. I mean, it's tough for me to say always, but the default is definitely to look to the women and girls. So we're ultimately taught that men and boys are essentially easily sexually tempted, let's say, and that women and girls who are not as easily sexually tempted, that's the narrative anyway, it's really their responsibility to maintain purity, to make sure that they don't bring out the almost inevitable sexuality of men and boys. So when sexuality does get into the mix, automatically people's reaction is to look to the women and girls and see what they had done to allow this to happen.
So how was that expressed to you as a teenager? What kinds of things did you have to do to toe the line?
You know, as I said earlier, it was just, it was always very difficult to pin down because everyone had a different definition. So that's why you walked with so much anxiety, really walking on eggshells because you weren't quite sure what was going to get you in trouble that day. You know, for instance, I remember once, having a long dress that was all the way down to my ankles and thinking, surely I won't get pulled aside for this dress. This I've been pulled aside for so many of my dresses and skirts, but this one, I'm not even showing my ankles. And then getting pulled aside and told, no, this dips too low in the back, and thinking, it's just impossible. It's just impossible for me to be pure within this community. There's always something that seems to be upsetting people because there was such a hypervigilance to make sure that that we were perfect, really.
So, Linda Kay, what went through your head when you started to feel stirrings with your first boyfriend?
Absolute terror. It was a mix between, such joy and excitement. I had a high school boyfriend who I think I really loved as much as you can love somebody in high school, really. I was crazy about him. We had been best friends before we started dating and dated a blissful 3 months. But with every sexual stirring also came the stirring of shame, because the way in which I had been taught sexuality or taught about sexuality by the church was with this shame-based frame. So when I say shame, I'm not talking about bashfulness or shyness. I'm talking about the research definition of shame, this feeling I am something bad or people will think that I am something bad, as opposed to, say, guilt, which is this feeling I did something bad. So we were really taught about sexuality using this shame-based frame. Even the concept of pure or impure, you are defining somebody in their totality, as something, based on one thing about them, their sexual expression or other people's perceptions of their sexual expression. So when I experienced shame in this high school relationship, what I mean is that I experienced a feeling of worthlessness or a fear that I was on the edge of worthlessness. Because if I wasn't pure, then how was I ever going to find a good Christian husband? How was I ever going to be loved? How was I ever going to function within this community that was my whole life?
So did you break up with Dean, as you call him in the book, because you were trying to save him or save yourself, or was it even that well defined?
Yeah, both. Both. I felt that God wanted me to break up with him, and I think that it was to protect both him and me. And actually, my journal entries will say that that's exactly what I thought. I remember, you know, writing about both of us needing to be protected.
Wow. So even though, I mean, this was when you were 16, I guess, your life choices led you away from that aspect of your religion and away from attending Bible college, which you'd thought about doing. How long a shadow did it cast, though, into your early adult life?
Yeah. When I left evangelicalism, which I did in my early 20s, you know, largely because I came to the conclusion that it didn't matter how many, you know, boyfriends I broke up with, I would never really be considered pure in this community. Perhaps it was my curvy body or my confidence or whatever it was, I was just never really going to belong. And when I left, I was under the impression that I would now be free of sexual shame. You know, I had come to the realization that sexuality and spirituality were not mutually exclusive. I felt like I was ready to engage sexuality in a healthy way. I was in my early 20s. I had a long-term boyfriend. I loved him, and I wanted to express my love for him sexually. And yet when I tried, I realized that my body had been trained in this shame for so long that it now lived inside of me and controlled me. So even though ultimately I, you know, believed that it would be healthy to have, you know, to have a sexual experience with this man, my body would stop me. I would have what my boyfriend called freakouts.
Okay, we'll pick the story up there on the other side of a break. Pure with Linda K. Klein, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Linda K. Klein is our guest, earned a master's degree studying American evangelical Christian gender and sexuality messages to girls. She's written a book about her own experiences and how many more people, it turned out, had similar experiences with the difficulties, the pressure placed on Christian evangelical women growing up to be pure. Her book is called Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you were talking about how by the time you'd reached your 20s, had broken away from evangelical Christianity, had a boyfriend you loved and wanted to express your love physically, that you were having body freakouts. How were those manifested?
Yeah, so ultimately I would break down into tears. My eczema that comes out when I'm stressed would come out, and I'd be scratching myself, you know, until I bled, and I would end up in a ball in the corner of the bed, just in a very unsexy way that prevented us from ever having sex. You know, and I felt so scared when this was happening, and I felt really alone because now I was in a secular world. Other people were not having these experiences, and I really felt like I was broken and would never have a healthy relationship or be a healthy person. And really, it wasn't until, as you referenced earlier, I started calling up my girlfriends that I had grown up with in the evangelical church and telling them what was happening to me, and that I started to realize I wasn't alone, as I sat with my jaw just dropped as they told me very similar stories from their own lives, you know, with the different details. Their lives were different, but with these same core experiences of sexual shame and fear and anxiety that were, for many of us, manifesting physically in ways that mimicked the classic symptoms of PTSD.
Wow. And not just the things that happened to your body, but the behaviors this would produce. What was the occasion of you taking your first over-the-counter pregnancy test?
I started taking pregnancy tests long before I had sex because I was so full of anxiety when I was having sexual experiences of any kind, you know, that I would be found out as being sexual by the community that I had left, but that I was still desperate to have approve of me, that I couldn't shake the feeling of fear and of anxiety until I would walk down to the drugstore and buy a pregnancy test and see that gorgeous minus sign that said that I was safe.
So as you reached back into your earlier community and found similar stories, I mean, was this just sort of an ever-widening circle with very similar experiences to what you had felt?
That's exactly right. You know, I had many intimate conversations over a series of years. And finally, in my mid-20s, I had so many conversations that I reached this moment where I said, I need to find out how many of us there really are who are experiencing this. And I went back to my hometown, called up all the girls I had grown up with in my youth group who I could get a hold of, and started talking to them over the course of a year about their adult relationship to sex and sexuality, and heard these stories again and again. And that became the catalyst for ultimately a 12-year quest in which I've been talking to people who were raised in white American evangelical churches as girls, like I was and like my peers were, around the country. And again, I hear these same stories. And again, people feel alone and they feel like they're the only ones and they feel like there's something wrong with them and it's their fault and they're the problem. And as they hear that there are others, you know, they, like I did, are able to say, oh, it's not me that's the problem. You know, something that was taught to me, something that was done to me is the problem. And that gives us the agency to be able to deal with it.
Just as an aside, did you explore any other religions? I'm curious to know if this is just a Christian thing, an evangelical Christian thing.
Over the more recent years, I've had so many conversations with people who were raised in other Christian communities and other religions and people who were raised in secular communities. And I hear these stories among them as well. And in fact, it's quite surprising to them even. They'll say to me, you know, I sat down with you thinking I would hear about, you know, those people. and ultimately, you know, I'm now here I am crying because you're telling me my story. And what I came to realize is that the evangelical community, you know, really what we're looking at is what a high dose of this toxic sexual shaming does to people, with the recognition that sexual shaming is a universal problem and that we are all ingesting some degree of this sexual shaming in our culture, in our other religious communities, and it's not healthy for any of us.
Linda K. Klein, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the book Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. Still Christian, not in the same way. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Are there some symbols and rituals for at least your branch of evangelical Christianity and how purity was enforced or celebrated or rites of passage, anything like that?
Well, there's a whole industry that I write about that started in the early 1990s, a purity industry. So you've got purity rings that people wear as a pledge to not have sex before marriage, purity pledges that people can take. You know, there are certainly purity-themed curricula and videos and all kinds of other products. But I think the thing that is the most remarkable to me is the purity-themed Bibles. So, for example, there's one purity-themed Bible where you have 60 pages of non-biblical material that is dedicated to the importance of sexual purity with rules like avoid the horizontal. So just imagine growing up and having, you know, about a sixth of your Bible be about the importance of remaining pure. You know, imagine not tying your sexuality to your salvation when that's the context that you're raised in.
So, and there is an effect, as you point out, on the rest of the culture. It gets larger than just the community of evangelical Christians. For example, you point out that the $2 billion have been spent on abstinence-only education since 1981. I imagine there are other manifestations, too.
Yeah, to be sure. And that government money really created the industry, I think, because you had previously, a rather localized focus with these purity messages and largely religious focus with these purity messages. But once we started to have money for abstinence only before marriage curricula in, provided to public schools and community-based organizations and so on, you know, a lot of these people who were developing this material for churches started to develop it for these other settings. So you really saw the boom result.
And you point out there's one group in particular called True Love Waits that lobbies for such funding with a number of tactics. What do studies show, though, and I think most of our audience probably knows this already, about the effectiveness of abstinence-only education?
Well, they are ineffective when it comes to the intended purpose, that is to prevent people from having sex. They don't meaningfully decrease the number of sexual partners one has. They don't meaningfully delay the age at which one has sex. However, they are incredibly effective at something else. They are incredibly effective at creating shame. And that's not just me saying that, despite the fact that I've spent 12 years talking to people and have seen that, to be sure. But there's new research right now that's coming out that's showing, particularly when these messages are taught in religious settings where these messages are taken quite seriously, that is the thing that it is the best at developing.
So for women who did, and you talked about talking to them for 12 years now, for women and their partners who did toe the purity line, did they report an effect on sex within marriage and the relationship itself?
Yes, that was one of the things that was the most startling to me at the very, very beginning of this process and what made me say, oh, this is a journey I need to go on. You know, when I went back to my hometown in that first year of interviews, you know, many of the people that I had grown up with were still evangelical, had never had sex, or were now married and hadn't had sex until marriage. Some of them hadn't even waited to have, or had even waited to have their kids, you know, at the altar. So they had done everything, you know, quote unquote, right. And yet they too were telling me these stories about sexual shame and fear and anxiety. And for them as well, they were manifesting in these physical ways that sometimes mimicked PTSD. And that was the first moment that it really shook me. You know, that was the first moment that I said, oh, it really isn't me. It really isn't my fault. Because, of course, shame, the experience of shame makes you blame yourself. It makes you separate from others, disconnect yourself from others. You know, you can go into self-blame. Oh, everything's wrong with me. You can go into blaming others. Oh, it's their fault. You can hide what you're experiencing. You know, different ways that you can distance yourself from others. But the result is that you can feel quite isolated. And that was my first realization that it wasn't my sinfulness and it wasn't my psychosis. This was really a widespread issue.
I'm not surprised to see a reference to hashtag Me Too in here, the Me Too movement. But what's Church Too?
Yes, so Church Too was a hashtag that was developed to basically aggregate stories of people who have experienced sexual harassment, sexual abuse within the church. You know, certainly there's a narrative in churches that the people in churches are good, are pure, are holy. You know, sexual problems don't happen here. Certainly not sexual abuse. Certainly not sexual violence. But you know, my conversations have made it quite clear that that is not the case. And the Church Too hashtag is a great hashtag that was started to be able to aggregate some of these stories so that we can start to bring recognition to the fact that this is happening in our churches as well.
Linda K. Klein, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. She spent 12 years talking to women with similar experiences and learned a lot. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Apart from sexuality, love, and that whole realm, you had a major thing happen to your body, a major bout with Crohn's disease that required surgery. And I'm just curious if that had an effect on your thinking about your body and God.
It did. You know, I really grew up telling myself that my body wasn't important. And, you know, that included my sexual body, but really just telling myself that I needed to be a person of the spirit, really, and that I should squash all of my physical needs and desires. And when I started to have really deep physical pain, you know, I certainly did go to doctors. You know, I wasn't going to completely ignore it. But when I was dismissed by those doctors, as so many young women are when they go to doctors, I ultimately said, you know, I must be suffering wrong. And I started to put less attention into getting better and more attention into suffering better, you know, and to having my body not control me and being a person of the spirit. And ultimately what ended up happening is I almost died. And when I realized that, you know, and was in the midst of a series of four surgeries, I said to myself, oh, there's something deep going on here. You know, this narrative, this fear that I have of my body that has caused me to so deeply suppress it is actually life-threatening to me.
So Linda Kay, the concept of stumbling blocks comes up again and again about how you have to avoid the stumbling blocks that will, you know, keep you from arriving at the altar pure, all of that. Where did your interpretation of the meaning of the phrase stumbling blocks start, and did it end up in a very different place?
It did, yes. Yeah, so that was a term that my friends and I were called stumbling blocks, you know, which is a thing over which men and boys can trip on their way to God. So, you know, so that was at first when I started being called a stumbling block, very offensive, I thought. But, you know, eventually your annoyance turns into anxiety when you're called something often enough. And I was quite startled. You know, as you mentioned earlier, I am still very much a Christian, and my faith is an incredibly important part of my life. And I was quite startled when I went back to the Bible and started to look at the context for this term stumbling block. Now, when people in the church talk about stumbling block, the verse that they usually reference is a verse where we're telling people, yes, you can eat whatever you want, but when you're around these people who don't eat these things, don't eat them because you don't want to be a stumbling block to those people. So generally, the analogy is drawn, yes, girls and women, you can technically wear whatever you want, but when you're around boys who are sexually tempted easily, you know, do them a solid and protect your brothers by actually dressing in a very modest way. So that's the analogy that's drawn. But when I was looking at that verse, I looked at it in its context, and I was really taken aback as I realized that the larger context for the chapter is about non-judgmentalism. So it's saying, yes, you can eat whatever you want, but, you know, don't judge them for not eating that. You know, this is not a big deal. You know, be a brother, be a sister, and be non-judgmental in these cases. And the entire chapter comes up again and again. Do not judge your brothers and sisters, for that is a stumbling block to their, you know, path to God. And I realized that this whole time that my friends and I had been called stumbling blocks, we were even then in that very moment having a stumbling block placed before us in the form of shame and judgmentalism that drove many of us out of the church. And ultimately, the only way that we really started to heal was when we started to do this story exchange and started to realize that we weren't alone. You know, I ultimately put myself through, you know, about 12 years of narrative therapy in which I told my story again and again and listened to my story in the stories of others, with the details different, of course, our lives are different, but the core message is the same. And that's what I really want to encourage people to be able to do, is to come into voice and to talk about the sexual shame that you've experienced, whether you grew up in the evangelical church or elsewhere, so that we can begin to journey through this together and begin to heal.
And I wonder, of the women that you've met and interviewed over the course of the 12-year project, and it's longer than that now, but if they reached moments of recognition as they talked to you, if they saw things in a different light and went, oh, wow, I never thought of that thing when I was 14 until now this way.
Absolutely. Yes. So many of my interviewees, I had a gap of 8, 9, 10 years between my first interview with them and my next interview with them. And it was incredible. You know, I would read back to people what they had said 10 years ago, and we would talk about it, and we would also talk about their modern day context. And the big thing that I came away with is ultimately, first of all, as we grow older, we see this more and more. We understand the way that it's impacting us more and more. We understand how it shows up in unexpected ways. But also, you know, my interviewees talked about how that first interview, when I asked them questions like, what were you taught about sexuality growing up and how did it impact you? Many of them said that just my asking that question and then giving them a space to really reflect on it, and then my telling them that what they answered wasn't an anomaly, that I'd heard it before, that I'd even experienced it in some cases, was life-changing. And 10 years down the road, you know, they were in a different place because they had actually reflected on these things that exposed, that stirred up some recognition that had continued to unfold over the next 10 years or whatever the number of years was. And this recognition that they weren't alone that allowed them to deal with the things when they got stirred up.
There's a story you relate in here, and I think it was from summer camp or some assembly like that, but that gives me this sense that what we're talking about here is not just trying to tamp down the physical sexual, you know, physical love part of you, but to tamp down women generally, because I got the sense that one of the major things you would get called out for as a young evangelical girl was for being outstanding.
Yeah, it was interesting. So the purity ethic is one man and one woman in marriage forever. And when we say one man and one woman in this ethic, what you're talking about is one highly masculine, stereotypical definition of a man, and one highly feminine, stereotypical definition of a woman. And, you know, so you're really expected to live out these gender expectations, which are summed up in the community as complementarianism. Complementarianism is this teaching that, you know, men are supposed to be loving leaders and women their supportive followers, and that so long as they stick to those roles, they will complement one another. But if either people, you know, steps out of their role, if the woman is not feminine enough, you know, the story that you're referring to, you know, the young girl who was called out at this retreat was called out because she was always raising her hand to answer the Bible question. Mm-hmm. You know, she was competitive in ways that people, you know, called her out for and said, you know, you're not living out this gender expectation.
Wow, so it goes well beyond the whole idea of sexuality and love, but it's an amazing journey for the reader, certainly. The book is called Pure: Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. Linda K. Klein, still happily a Christian, but in a very different way. Thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you. I so appreciate it.